Welcome. This is an audio recording of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. The Council is a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to engaging the public in an exploration of global issues and foreign affairs, and we produce over 80 public events each year. To learn more about us or to become a member, visit dfwworld.org. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
My name is Bob Jance. I'm with New York Times here in Dallas. And my good friend Lucy Witt is saying, Bob's in front of a microphone. That's always trouble. I'll be brief, Lucy. It's an honor to be here today and introduce Kip Tindall, Chairman and CEO of The Container Store. And it's also good to see so many executives from The Container Store here, a special few that I've had the pleasure to work with, opportunity to know over the years, including Melissa Reif, Lucy Witt, Casey Schilling, Audrey Robertson, and Melissa Collins. I also want to recognize Sharon Tindall, whom we all owe a lot of credit for making our distinguished speaker what he is today, an extraordinary leader. The New York Times organization has been very fortunate to have a long-standing partnership with The Container Store for the past 10 years. And it just so happened to coincide with The Container Store's incredible, amazing growth, expanding to 63 stores by year end. That includes 4 successful stores in New York with 2 blockbuster stores in Manhattan. Notice I got that in. Kip and Sharon, Garrett Boone, Melissa Reif, are just the tip of the iceberg of The Container Store's huge success. Kip and Sharon and the senior management team will be the first to tell you that success starts with good people, hardworking people who want to make a difference and be a part of something truly extraordinary and special. On the front page of The Container Store's website, there is a message from Kip, and I quote, "We take it seriously that our employees choose to spend much of their life's journey with us," end of quote. The Container Store's culture is built on faith, determination, and a team-oriented belief that anything is possible if the team works together toward a common goal. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, I'd like to introduce an extraordinary leader, a visionary, a journeyman, Kip Tindall. Kip?
Thank you, Bob, for that wonderful introduction. And to all of you for inviting me to join you today. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm worried about having 2 mics here. Oh, this one. Sorry about that. Thank you. There we go. Okay. Sorry. Even though we're in Dallas, how many of you are familiar with the store and have shopped the store? Oh, thank you. Thank you. And bless you for that, and please redouble your efforts, okay? And it's always fun to talk in Dallas because of that. And, we tried to build an organization where people identify with the brand so well they feel a part of the brand. And I know that's true because I run into people, it seems like about once a week, where someone says, "Kip, you remember your first store at Preston Forest in 1978? I was your first customer on that first day, on July the 1st of 1978, and I've had about 100 people tell me that over the years. And there's only one, but I mean, I know that person feels a part of the Container Store, and they feel a part of that brand, and it makes us feel great. People are talking about saving space and time, but what we're really selling is time. Somehow, we kind of sort of knew back in 1978 that time was the most valuable commodity we all have. And so you're saving space, you know, you're getting organized. There's a certain Zen quality to all that. But what really feels good is having a little bit more time because you're reasonably well organized. I don't think there's any doubt about it that if you want to accomplish half of what we accomplish in life, being a little bit more organized helps you do that. Right now we're having a big travel sale. And I think just being organized when you travel kind of makes the stress less and allows you to travel a little bit easier. Over 60 stores from coast to coast, four more stores this year. We're opening a lot of stores right now, about six a year. Most retailers are being a little cautious because the economy is still pretty checkered. We've done an interesting thing. We're ready to finally open in Canada and Europe. Everybody's always trying to get us to open in Europe and Japan. And I don't want to live our lives and not see that happen, and it will happen. Of course, I've been saying in about 4 years, I've been saying that for about 20 years. But what happened was we started opening stores in markets like Indianapolis, Nashville, Charlotte, Raleigh. And those stores do as well as the stores in Chicago, L.A., New York, but they only cost about half as much. So the profitability of those stores is so wonderful that we've kind of delayed, again, Canada, London, that type of thing, because there's a lot more risk to opening your first store in London than there is your first store in Nashville. The company's built on seven values-based philosophies we call our foundation principles. And that's really what I want to talk about. These foundation principles really and truly do guide all of our business decisions. And we learned early on that I was always a big advocate of, you know, the kind of code of conduct you follow, your kind of life view of things that you follow personally, that should be the same as your code of conduct for business. And I think some people get confused about that. You know, you hear people say, it's not acceptable to have kind of a looser code of conduct for business than you do for your personal life, right? You know, but you hear people say, well, you got to understand, it's just business. And I'm like, no, that's not acceptable, really. So it's the same code of conduct. And the seven foundation principles, I'm going to cover a couple of them today, but you can see them all. I'd love for you to look at them on our blog. We've got a blog at the Container Store called What We Stand For. And we're really big on companies, you know, having a purpose beyond profit. And as I'll go to today, being a purpose-driven company, ironically enough, actually helps with the profits. I mean, because you know, your employees are more fervently a part of things. Your vendors are more part of things. And so it works to enrich your lives and the lives of the people you do business with. But also, we really believe that if all you want to do is make as much money as humanly possible, as rapidly as possible, that's also the way to go about doing it. So it's nice that it works out that way. We're trying to create a business where everyone associated with the organization thrives. Isn't that a fun concept? We're trying to create an organization where everyone associated with the business thrives. The employees thrive, the vendors do, the customers do, the community does. Everyone associated with it thrives. We like to joke that even our bankers and lawyers thrive, you know? I mean, everybody associated with it thrives. That's a little bit similar to the concept of conscious capitalism. I think our seven foundation principles and conscious capitalism are the same thing. John Mackey spoke at this event a couple of months ago, and in fact, I introduced him, and he went into the concept of the stakeholder model, which is kind of like the stakeholders as opposed to just focusing on the shareholders. We simultaneously try to make sure that all of the stakeholders of the organization thrive. That is what conscious capitalism is really based upon. And I think that companies that do that well, I think they're slowly becoming the companies that are dominating their niche everywhere. So, we do that with all stakeholders, but we're first and foremost an employee-first company. Of all of our stakeholders, it's really the employees that we put first. The famous economist Milton Friedman once said, the only reason a corporation exists is to maximize the return of the shareholders. You've heard that, you know, Milton said that. And so we're like, well, Milton, with all due respect, I know you won a Nobel Prize and everything, but we at the Container Store actually believe that if you put the employee first, and focus and really and truly take better care of the employee than anybody else, then she really and truly will take better care of the customer than anybody else. And if those two people are ecstatic, well, then ironically and wonderfully enough, the shareholder's going to be ecstatic and great too, right? Does that make sense? And it sounds too good to be true, but it absolutely works. So you're balancing all of those stakeholders, starting with the employee, you know, the customer, the vendors. I love dealing with the vendors. Sharon is our chief merchant and always has been. It really is. People always hear a lot about Garrett Boone and me, but I think Sharon's really the key reason for the company. After all, it's a retail business. Product matters, right? But it's so joyful to treat your employees that way, but it's also so joyful to treat your vendors that way. And at the Container Store, you really can't tell the difference between a vendor and an employee. If you really do just myopically focus on the shareholder, it loses the magic. You know, the employee's not happy, the customer's not happy, and ultimately the shareholder's not happy either. So this starts with one of our foundation principles that we call hiring 1 equals 3 employees. You know, 1 great employee is equal to 3 good employees. That's one of our key foundation principles. And that's really kind of an understatement, you know. Each of us can do several things more than 3 times as effectively as somebody else. I mean, Phil Mickelson's more than 3 times as effective as Kip Tindall on the golf course, right? And so it's really like 25 times or something like that. But if you really believe that 1 great person can do the business productivity of 3 good people, well, then why would you ever want to hire anybody other than great people? You know, but someone in your position or someone in my position has to really believe that it's possible to attract and keep great people, particularly to work in a retail environment or to work in a distribution center. We've got a 1 million square foot distribution center right here in Coppell, and a lot of those folks on the receiving dock have been there for 25 years, and they are great. So we joke that 1 great's equal to 3 good, 1 good's equal to 3 average, 1 average is equal to 3 lousy. So I guess 1 great person, 1 great employee is equal to about 27 lousy employees. And so great people are harder to find, they're harder to keep. We pay them well. We pay about 50 to 100% above industry average for those great people. The people that wait on you in the store, the full-time salespeople, make about $50,000 a year, which is not a tremendous amount of money in this day and age, but it's a lot of money for a retail salesperson, and it is about double industry average. And we train them really well. I'm embarrassed to tell you that the average retailer trains their people about 8 hours of formal training a year, and we do that 263 hours a year. So we really develop these great people, really invest in the training. And as a result, we never lose them. People join this company, and they never leave. When you go into the store, you really are being helped by people who have been there for 5 and 15 and 20 years. We also communicate absolutely everything to them. What makes somebody feel a part of an organization more than knowing that absolutely everything is communicated to them at all times? If you go to boil down culture, in my opinion, you know, after thinking about it for, I'm wearing a 30-year employee pin here. We're celebrating our 35th anniversary. And people say, really, 35 years? And I say, no, that was my dad. It wasn't me. You know. But if you boil it down, I think it's about 2 things, and one of them is really communication. You know, it's communication and working with great people. I mean, I want to work with the greatest people possible, don't you? I mean, if you started that golf team, I only play golf twice a month. I don't know why I'm talking about golf so much, but wouldn't it make you feel great if Phil Mickelson was on the team? You know, and wouldn't that make you just feel so proud to be a part of that? So I think we boil it down to 2 things. It's really communication is leadership, and the 1 equals 3 great people. And then it's a blend of work and play. We're really kind of nuts about excellence and everything, and we, so balance. I'm not very good at talking about balance. I mean, family and friends come first, absolutely, but, you know, when Monet was painting the water lilies, was he working or playing? I mean, He was always out there painting those water lilies. Was he working, or was he doing what he wanted to do? And I think that's what we're doing. Sharon and I are so nuts that we're probably working as hard now as we were in the second year of the business. But we love it, and it keeps getting better. And we get to work with these great people that we've worked with for 5 and 25 years that we love absolutely like family. I also think that you have a kind of a moral obligation to create a place where people really love coming to work in the morning. All of our employees spend more time, more waking hours working than anything else. And so, you know, let's make sure that we're creating a place they love getting out of bed and coming to work in the morning. It's kind of that simple. That's a never-ending journey. And in return, a friend of mine called Lou Carbone, who's a brilliant guy, you can Google him, Lou Carbone. Lou says that the first 25% of any employee's productivity is mandatory. First 25% is mandatory. They have to do that to keep from getting fired. But the next 75% is completely voluntary. And so we're the only retailer I know that didn't lay anybody off during the Great Recession. You know, this. I mean, you can't be an employee-first culture and go laying people off the first time you have. So, but I really think our employee productivity is like in the 80s or 90s in the Lou Carbone scale of, you know, not the 25, you know, the 25%. I also think that it's so joyful to develop and teach and deal with managers, department managers and store managers who understand the human spirit. A bad manager is kind of a Napoleonic complex guy that, you know, is sure that all the employees want to come to work in the morning and goof off as much as possible and accomplish as little as possible, but that guy doesn't really understand the human spirit. The human spirit is you want to come to work in the morning and you want to work with other great people that and accomplish wonderful things together as a team, because team is one of the most beautiful of all life experiences, and then go home at night with this supreme satisfaction that you've done great things with these great people. Now, that's what the human spirit's all about, and that's kind of what you have to have in managers, understanding that that's what people are looking for, and then managing with that in mind, with the true essence of the human spirit in mind. So that creates trust. That creates low turnover. We have something like 8% turnover in an industry. The retail industry, unfortunately, is like 115%, you know, which means the average retail worker in America doesn't even last a year. I mean, you can't train them. You can't do anything with that. Herb Kelleher put it really well, and one of the first times I just stopped in my tracks was Herb saying, hey, you can build a much better organization on love than you can fear. And so he was saying that like 30 or 35 years ago. And we've really, he also taught us to have fun at work. You know, I go up to store managers and say, is that all you got? Can't you be more fun than that? I mean, retail is hard, and you know, but you don't have to be serious all the time. So fun and building an organization on love. And you're starting to hear people talk about love, even men talking about love as part of a corporate culture and that type of thing. And I think that's so important. The customers are, of course, obviously people think it's funny that we put the employee even above the customer. Well, you know, we do that so they take better care of the customers. But I think customers want an emotional connection with a brand. That's when you really have something. Your favorite pair of shoes, your favorite tie, your favorite car, that transcends value. My favorite tie, every time I wear it, I get not two or three comments, I get 18 or 20 comments. And, you know, I'm human. At the end of the day, I'm feeling like, you know, I'm looking pretty good today, you know. I mean, which I bought it at a Bergdorf Goodman. I paid a lot for it. But don't you think it was worth what I paid for it? You know, it's just that emotional connection transcends value. People are beginning to vote with their pocketbook. Thank goodness. It's not just millennial age kids that are beginning to vote with their pocketbook and support companies that they really approve of the way they are. Us old baby boomers are starting to vote with their pocketbook. We just feel better about really being a big supporter, a big customer of, a big fan of various companies who agree with our sort of life philosophy and our view of lives, and you know, do things to give back to the community and treat their employees well and deal very fairly with their with their customers. And you know, some examples I think are Whole Foods, Southwest Airlines, Google, REI, Costco. Google Jim Senegal and look into his philosophies. You know, he just retired, but Jim Senegal would tell a shareholder, if you don't like me paying the employees double what somebody else pays them, then go, you know, go buy that other warehouse club's stock. You, sell your Costco stock. Go buy his stock. You know, and so I just think it's great. Trader Joe's is a pretty good example as well. Customers feel like employees. Hopefully they don't like us. Hopefully they love us. They're kind of proud of us, you know. I mean, really, when we go to a cocktail party, so it gets around to what you do. The containers say, "Oh my God!" They go, they're proud of us, and not just in Dallas, in New York, and in Los Angeles, and all of that too. So I guess what I'm saying is that when a company behaves this way, you start getting evangelical support from employees and customers. And vendors are part of that too. You start getting vendors who really want to see you succeed. And what it results in is it results in the world kind of conspiring to assist you. And it's a whole lot easier to succeed in business if everybody wants to see you win than it is if everybody's laying awake at night trying to figure out how to get back at you. You know, I mean, it's just so cool to have so many of our vendors constantly saying, you know, you're my favorite customer, and here's why. One of our other foundation principles is Andrew Carnegie's laying on his deathbed somewhere in the Adirondacks, and it's not the Adirondacks. Where is it? No, say that. The Berkshires. Yeah, the Berkshires. I gave a commencement speech last weekend in Boston, and so I had it right there because the Berkshires are in Massachusetts, right? But and so this cub reporter comes out of New York and says, Mr. Carnegie, you're probably the most famous industrialist of all time. Is there anything you attribute all of your business success to? He said, yeah, there's one thing. There's one beacon, one guiding light. Fill the other guy's basket to the brim. Making money then becomes an easy proposition. Fill the other guy's basket to the brim. Making money then becomes an easy proposition. He said that that was what he attributed all of his business success to. And that really became our primary, it became sort of our business philosophy. It's about crafting mutually beneficial relationships with your vendors. And it's the most fun thing you can do in business. I think I would probably be a fly fishing guide somewhere in Colorado if I didn't believe in the power of that. And so how did the little container store get kind of big and deal with the mass merchants? Well, I mean, you can't beat those guys in volume, right? If we're buying Rubbermaid and they're buying Rubbermaid, they're buying 100 times more Rubbermaid than us. But we get a better price on Rubbermaid than they do because we have a better relationship with the vendor than they do. So if you can't beat them on volume, try beating them on relationships. And so then you go for 30 or 35 years building this outstanding relationship with this manufacturer, and synergy begins to happen, and you're learning so much. You can't really love somebody until you know them really well, right? The deeper your relationship goes, the more you can do things together. Same with the vendor. And so these huge synergies begin to take place between you and your vendors, and you can create a synergistic relationship. That's where the real money is made in business, we believe. If you look at the companies that completely dominate their niche, that's what they're doing. You know, they're not laying awake at night trying to screw each other around. They're trying to do the exact opposite. And so I think that's so inspiring. I'm modestly very proud of the way the container store behaves. You know, we're mindful of our wake, W-A-K-E, like a boat's wake, and that's one of my favorite things. And I talked a lot about it at the commencement speech this weekend. Everything you do and everything you don't do impacts, you know, your business and your employees and your family and your friends far, far, far more than you think it does. I mean, everything you do and everything you don't do impacts everybody around you so much more than you think it does. All of us are so much more impactful and powerful than we think we are. I mean, I know it's corny, but It's a Wonderful Life is probably my favorite movie, because the whole movie is about showing this one guy the incredible power of his wake, right? And I think all of our wakes are just so much bigger than we can imagine. And I think that businesses that are mindful of their wake are a pretty good summation of what conscious capitalism is all about. And I think that when you get an entire organization to be mindful of its wake, everybody in it, that adds up to an unassailable business advantage that nobody can really compete with. So I think wake is important. I think transparency is important. You know, guys came out of World War II and they came home and started businesses, and they began to run businesses in sort of a command, top-down, militaristic way, and expressions like loose lips, sink ships were common. And now we're realizing that employees and customers are demanding transparencies And you know, women are like 70 percentile in all the top business schools now. They're taking over the medical industry. You know, so you're having this transparency take place in American business, and you're having this wonderful feminization of American business take place, which leads to a little bit, yes, sorry about the generalizations, but a little bit gentler, a little more communicative style. I mean, guess who tends to communicate better? If communication is leadership, like we believe at the Container Store, guess who tends to communicate better? And a little bit more of a conscious business. So I think that the companies that will dominate tomorrow are more feminine, more transparent, more conscious than the ones of yesterday. Plus, operating this way enriches your life and the lives of the people you do business with, but I think it's the best way to get to the point where everyone thrives. And as I started this little quick presentation, I said that we're kind of making up our own rules because nobody taught us how to do this, but we're just conscious of, we want everyone associated with the Container Store to really thrive, and we're constantly learning how to do that better for our vendors and better for our employees and better for the community and better for everyone associated with it. So I think that's a fun, honorable pursuit, trying to do a business where everybody thrives, don't you? And thank you for having me here today, and I think we have time for a couple of questions.
Absolutely. As is the tradition with the World Affairs Council, the first question goes to a student. And it's a Martin High School Junior World Affairs Council student. And his or her question is, how did your philosophy studies affect the way that you run your business? And I just detected so much philosophical wisdom in what you said, so I'd love for you to address your philosophical studies.
Well, I don't know. I actually went to Jesuit High School in Dallas, and I graduated from Jesuit in 1971, and at that time we had a lot of young priests that were really existential and philosophically oriented, and so I kind of got into all that stuff. I really enjoyed reading and learning about that, and so a few of these thoughts came from that, but the foundation principle is conscious. It's not religious. It's just kind of, it is a little bit existential, though, and so you're if you start something, and I hope all of you students start something, you know, you don't all have to work on Wall Street, you don't all have to work for big companies, go start something. The world is better off when people go out and start things like Whole Foods, right? I mean, the world's richer and better, and you get to sort of build the corporate culture around your own philosophies of life and everything, and I think, and they should be the same, life philosophy and business philosophy, so that's a really giant privilege and responsibility. And I think you have to, if you're going to be good at it, it's going to have to be your core. It's going to have to be you, you know, or you're not going to be able to remain true to them. And I was texting last night Indra, whatever her name is, the CEO of Pepsi-Cola. And she's really interested in conscious capitalism. And she's willing to meet me because I wanted to meet her and talk. Because everybody says, how do you go into a huge company and change the culture and make it a conscious or foundation principle? And so it's her philosophies that are doing that there. So I think it's harder to go change a big company like Pepsi than it is to start a little big company like Container Store and do that. But it works in both ways.
Great answer. And could I get a show of hands of how many people have questions? Because I think we have time for maybe three questions. Is that about right?
So I was okay time-wise.
You were beautiful. Yes, perfect. Yes, in the very back, very, very back, the gentleman in the very far back. Uh-huh.
Most people stayed away. Thank you.
I hate to ask this mundane business question, but how is your strategy for growth in brick-and-mortar stores affected by the amazing growth of internet sales?
You know, differentiation is so key to that. About Sharon doesn't like me to quantify it, but somewhere like 70% of our products are proprietary. You know, we're trying to do those products that Amazon and those guys have a little bit harder time doing because they're exclusive to the Container Store. We strive for legendary customer service, which is really, you've got to go to the trouble to go to a store, you better have legendary, there better be some benefits of it. But however she wants to shop, you know, if she wants to order online and pick it up at the store, it's so funny, we have this thing called Click and Pick Up. We'll let you order it online, and then we'll meet you outside the store and give you your package, you know. That goes against everything I learned in retail. You know, Stanley Marcus was, he was dying. He would just roll over, you know. Remember how there used to be mazes in stores to where once you got in, it was kind of hard to find the exit and all of that type of thing. But that'll get you a couple of extra visits a year. And so, of course, everybody knows the multi-channel customer is the best customer by far. And whatever, you know, whatever she wants to do. But differentiation from is important on that. Service is important on that. Product differentiation because, you know, you can't just be a showroom. And I'm vice chairman of the National Retail Federation. We're also making progress on what we call the sales tax fairness thing. The Senate just passed it. The House will probably take a year, but they'll pass it too. And, you know, then that'll help too.
Great. Okay. The gentleman in the middle table here. Yes?
What?
We have a microphone for you. There we go. Uh-huh.
This is one of the best bass fishermen in Texas right here.
Kevin, is your company an ESOP company or striped out its ownership's made?
Yeah. No, it's owned entirely by the employees and a slight majority by Leonard Green and Company, a private equity firm. And we love Leonard Green. This is the biggest oxymoron you'll ever hear. But we have kind of turned, they will tell you that we've turned them into sort of a conscious capitalist private equity firm. That's the oxymoron. Conscious capitalist private equity, believe that. But we can't get them to tell us what to do even when we want it. Well, they only have like 20 employees, so they can't run our business, right? But, you know, we went through over 100 private equity firms. J.P. Morgan said it was the most that anybody had ever interviewed, and we found the one that was right for us. And I got him to do a thing with Whole Foods. You know the great restaurateur, Danny Meyer, out of New York, his great restaurants, they just did a thing with him. Because these guys are a little bit like us, and we, sometimes I'll go, look, I need to buy some Swedish kroner, and I think this is good. Oh, Kip, I'd rather go with your gut on it. You know, I mean, but that's really who you want for a financial partner. You don't want them trying to tell Sharon what Christmas wrap to pick, right? We love them, and they also understand that it's very important to get stock in the hands of employees. And Sharon and I have been diluting ourselves and making sure that these other people who will be running the business after us have as much equity as possible in the business because you don't really gain a lot of financial independence by salary and bonus. It takes equity to really do that over a long period of time. And so we try to share the fortunate value creation that we've done through the equity by getting it in the hands. And so about 6 years ago, we did this deal with Leonard Green, and Sharon and I sold maybe about 40% of our stock and got enough money in return, more than anybody deserves to have. And so now we're kind of more interested in doing it for the people we've been working with for 20 or 30 years than doing it for ourselves. That's easy once you kind of get up farther up Maslow's hierarchy of need, right? You're kind of in good shape then. But I found that to be more motivating than doing it for yourself. You know, these does that make sense? And so it helps to have a very sophisticated investor, just one or a few. And this sounds funny, but you have to make sure, if you're going to be an employee-first organization, that that investor understands that it's better to own 50% of a dollar than 100% of a nickel. Because everyone will agree that they want the employees to get more stock, but it's usually hard to find your private company investors when it comes time to get diluted. So, you know, yeah, it's much better on 50% of a dollar than 100% of a nickel, so we need to dilute ourselves occasionally and make sure that these people that are really building the company share in that value creation too.
So. Great. And did we have one last question? Yes, Frank.
My question is, what happened to JCPenney and what would be your advice?
Leave it to Frank.
That's a fun and great question. And I'm friends of Ron Johnson, and I'm friends of Mike Ullman, and so it's not one I really want to answer. but we sure have followed it from with great interest. And people wanted big change, and then Ron got a lot of resistance to that change. Mike's probably a great guy to come back and fix that. I think a lot of employees got hurt, and I'm not going to answer.
Well, thank you for all your wisdom that you've shared with us today. And I have a presentation of hopefully what will be your second favorite tie. And it's a World Affairs Council tie.
I love that. Thank you so much. Thank you.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.